You may proceed when you're ready. Would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
I'm sorry, 3 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the Court, my name is Catherine Dougherty. I represent the appellant in this matter, Gary D. Knight, Jr. This is a matter dealing with adoption consent. The case originated in the juvenile court where the appellees filed their petition asking the court to find that Mr. Knight's consent had been withheld contrary to the best interest of the child. The matter was then appealed to the Norfolk Circuit Court. And this appeal has come from that ruling of that court. This court has raised questions of jurisdiction, and I believe that those issues are dispositive. I'd like to begin with those. The juvenile court never had jurisdiction to hear this matter because this was brought as a parental placement adoption. Section 63.2.1233 is in the adoption part of the code chapter, and it's under Article 3.
This wasn't a parental placement, was it?
It was not, Your Honor.
Social services placed a child.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Social services was involved at the beginning to arrange for the child to go home from the hospital with the birth mother, and then when the birth mother indicated that she would come pick up the child, the Department of Social Services filed an emergency removal order. And the child was then legally placed with the Autrixes under that emergency removal order. There was a preliminary removal order entered. There was then a dispositional order that granted custody to the Autrixes.
Was jurisdiction ever raised in the juvenile court?
It was not, Your Honor, but this is a matter of... No, Your Honor. Subject matter jurisdiction can never be waived.
Is this subject matter jurisdiction?
It is, Your Honor, because this is the jurisdiction of the juvenile court over a parental placement adoption. The code gives both the circuit court and the juvenile court the right to hear consent matters, but the consent matter for juvenile court is limited to parental placement adoptions under 16.1241U. That is where the juvenile court's jurisdiction is given for a parental placement adoption.
Let me ask you about what I think is the biggest hurdle you've got in this case, and that is whether we have jurisdiction. And that depends on whether or not the order appealed from is in fact a final order of the circuit court.
Yes, Your Honor.
The circuit court entered an order that it clearly did not believe to be a final order. It's got language in there that I interpret, and I think it later interpreted in a letter opinion, as requiring an adoption decree to be entered before it was final. And I think the court made it clear in events that occurred subsequent to the notice of appeal being filed that the order appealed from was not a final order. How can we get past that particular issue?
Your Honor, I do believe it was a final order because it dealt with the whole subject of consent in that order. The court, after a lengthy hearing on February 15th, went through all the factors, and those matters are on the record. And they did instruct the appellee's attorney to prepare a final order, but then they entered an order dealing with all those issues
in terms of consent.
Did
the court cross out, the final part of that order, and then later, in August of this year, enter the same order that it then said was a final order?
It did, Your Honor.
So how was the order appealed from the final order in this case?
The order that was the court later entered was substantially and substantively the same as the February 15th order. Nothing changed in that. So,
but it wasn't entered non pro tonque.
It was not.
It was a new order, was it not?
It was, Your Honor. But I believe that the February 15th order was final because it dealt with it, and all that had to be done was that for that order to be typed. In fact, the order that was entered on August 7th was the typed order, that kind of administrative act that needed to be done with any change that I would say did not go to any of the substance or any of the issues that were before the court.
The order that was ultimately entered, and that's that order of August 7th, the court entered a subsequent order in which it suspended the order entered on August 7th. Now, I recognize there were two orders entered on August 7th, but how do we know which one is suspended or whether both have been suspended?
Well, that was a question I had as well, Your Honor, but I believe that August 7th order did say that the final order that was entered on August 7th was the one that was suspended, and the court had indicated at the top of that was a final order.
But if that order was suspended, then where's the final decree?
Well, Your Honor, we would still argue that the February 15th order was a final order. That order was never suspended.
Well, there were two orders. The suspending order says the order entered on August 7th. Could that have applied to another order besides the order dealing with the J&D appeal?
I'm trying to remember because there were a number of orders then. I'm sorry, Your Honor. You're asking about the August 7th order, the suspension.
There's two orders entered. There's one order entered that denies the motion to rehear the consent, denies the motion to unseal the adoption file, grants the motion to vacate the adoption, and grants sanctions against counsel. And then on the same day, he enters the order that replicates the original order pertaining to the appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then we get this order, this vague order that suspends the order entered on August 7th. And when I'm talking about our jurisdiction, I'm having a hard time figuring out why there's a final order on that issue.
Well, again, Your Honor, we'll go back to the argument from Salem Loan and Trust Company that it's an order that disposes of the whole subject and gives all the relief.
But I understand that, but it's suspended. And if the court suspended, its 21 days has not started running. It lays in the breast of the court for at least those 21 days. It's not final.
Well, we do have, subsequent to the entry of the order in February 7th, we have the court appointing me as an attorney in this matter and the Court of Appeals, which would indicate that that was a final order. The February 15th was a final order, and also an order appointing Ms. Bailey as a guardian ad litem going forward. We have the court then transmitting the record and all these indications that the court saw that as a final order as well, and that's
well,
where
what
we
did the order that was suspended. How is that different or alike to the order that you claim still is in effect?
It is virtually identical, Your Honor, in terms of the substance of this. Of the consent matter.
So why would the trial court suspend an order that contained the same language that you argue was still in effect?
I believe, I don't know for certainty, Your Honor, but I think it had to do with the subsequent matters that came up because of issues that had been brought to the attention of counsel, but I can't answer that, Your Honor. I don't know. But what I think is clear is this isn't a parental placement adoption. The parents did not place this child. Social services placed this child. And even if the court were to find that the mother's original agreement that the child go from the hospital was a placement, it certainly doesn't fit the category of a placement for the purpose of foster care or adoption.
Under the code for parental placement, if the juvenile court found that neither one of them consented, doesn't the statute say that it has to be dismissed and takes no further action?
I think that would be true, Your Honor, but I think even underlying that is the whole issue of the subject matter jurisdiction of a parental placement adoption. Even 1233.3 has to rise above that issue of whether it's a parental placement adoption.
Can you tell us, you say this is not a parental placement, but can you tell us where in the record we can find something to establish that? Because the record is voluminous, and the original placement goes back, I think it's 2006 or so.
Well, Your Honor, I think we can point to several things that would show that it's not a parental placement adoption. First, we have the emergency removal order, and you find that in the appendix at page 90. You find that in the appendix at page 197 through 202. You have the preliminary removal order, which is in the appendix, pages 203 to 204. You have the juvenile court dispositional order granting custody at pages 205 to 207. And it's interesting, if you look at that dispositional order, you would find in the section dealing with a foster care plan, it's marked as not applicable. That's under number 2. And then there's a supplement to the order at page 207 that indicated it was a transfer to a relative or other interested party to dispose of a petition, in this case alleging abuse or neglect. And it does not mark anything about a foster care plan there because it's not a foster care case. But all those would be indications that this was a placement by the social services and not by the parents.
But wouldn't the code require foster care reviews if it's a placement by social services?
Only if it's a foster care case, Your Honor. And this was a matter which was, they were indicating was either a relative placement or other interested individual. And under those cases, there's no need for a foster care plan. That's why the dispositional order says it's NA, not applicable.
Counsel, you're already into your rebuttal time. Certainly, you may go ahead and use it, but you may, if you'd like to say it.
I'd just like to reserve my time, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Before you get too comfortable, is this a parental placement case?
Yes, Judge, it is. And that actually goes to my first point today, Judge. And may it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Schubert.
Well, I'm glad I anticipated that.
Judge, there are several reasons why this case is a parental placement adoption. If you look at the definition of a parental placement adoption, there are a couple of things that it says. The definition itself says that it's a placement of the child where either the parents or the legal guardians of the child could place the child for adoption. So there's a couple of elements I think the court has to look at. Number one, originally this child was placed with my clients by the mother. The record reflects...
Let me stop you. This case was placed with your client by DSS.
No, Judge.
On page 80 of the record, not the appendix of the record, is the dispositional order for underlying petition foster care plan, which says, upon disposition, the court orders the custody transferred to Kahala Ruley and Howard Ortiz. And that came from DSS, not the parents. If the parents had done it, it would be a totally different procedure.
Sort of, Judge. What happened prior to that, you have to look at what the record says prior to that. If you look at the petition that's related to the emergency removal order, I believe that's about 198 of the record, it indicates the affidavit of one of the agency workers. And what she says in conjunction with the testimony of my clients was, prior to DSS getting involved at that stage of the proceedings, the mother actually identified my clients to have the child go home with them from the hospital.
Who had legal custody of the child when it left the hospital?
My clients, Judge. Either the adoptive parents or my clients. There was no order entered at the time that the child went home with my clients from the hospital. I believe the testimony reflects the child was born on November 20th. My client testified that the child came home with them from the hospital on or about November 24th. So about 4 days old, the child came directly home from the hospital with my clients. The record is unclear about what happened between that time period and the entry of the first order, which was the emergency removal order. But the affidavit shows that what happened at that time was that after my clients were identified as a placement for the child, my client testified, and the affidavit indicates that the intention was to allow my client to have the child until the birth mother could get herself together. And then subsequent to that, something happened where the whereabouts of the birth parents were unknown.
Assume we get over that hurdle as to whether this is even a parental placement in the first instance. The mother in this case did not consent to the adoption issue.
That's correct.
63.212-33, which is the statute, the parental placement statute, says that except as provided in subdivisions 4 and 5, which are not applicable here, if consent cannot be obtained from at least one birth parent, the J&D court shall deny the petition and go on to determine custody pursuant to another statute. So how did the court end up making a disposition when the statute divests it of jurisdiction if one of the parents doesn't consent?
Judge, I would argue that statute does not completely divest the juvenile court of jurisdiction at that time. There were several other things, options for the juvenile court to make rulings related to the consents necessary or required by the statute. For example, the amended petition filed by my clients indicated a request for the court to make a ruling under 63.2-1202 subsection H. That statute specifically says that essentially the juvenile court can make a ruling that the parents' consents are not required because they haven't been in contact with the child within 6 months.
The court specifically did not rely on that statute.
Correct, but it was pled and it was before the court at that time. So they had the jurisdiction under that particular statute to make that ruling one way or the other. And then in addition...
But the court has jurisdiction if it makes that finding. If it doesn't make that finding, then it has no jurisdiction because the parents haven't consented.
Correct, Judge, but that still allowed the birth father, when the birth father appealed that decision of the court, it was a de novo to the circuit court. So the circuit court still had the opportunity to make a finding under that, which it did in this particular case. But that would not preclude the circuit court from making that jurisdiction. I would also argue in relation to 1233 subsection 3, Judge, Your Honor, that at that point the statute can be interpreted to tell the juvenile court that when no other option is available, that's a dead end. But my understanding, Judge, from reading the statutes and the intention of what the drafters intended at that time, is that's intended for a case where the parents come in, maybe they change their mind. There's a different intention there.
When we interpret statutes, we start with the plain meaning, the plain language of the statute, and I don't see how subsection 3 of that statute can be any clearer. The court shall deny the petition and go on to determine custody elsewhere.
The reason, Judge, I would argue that it is a little ambiguous is because it conflicts with the other statutory provisions that allow the jurisdiction of that allow the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court to make other findings. The statutes just previous to that allow the court to make findings related to the birth parent's consent being withheld contrary to the best interest of the child.
That's only one birth parent, though. You can find one birth parent's consent being withheld contrary to the interest of the child, but that requires the other to have consented before you even get to that step.
Judge, if you read the statutes as a whole, and of course the statutory scheme, our case law says that adoption statutes should be liberally construed to harmonize the statutes. You have a conflict there. I think that's clear. And what I would argue to the court today is that this particular instance is a little bit of a hybrid case. It is not a clear-cut parental placement, but it is definitely not an agency placement. We don't have those provisions. It is not a step-parent adoption. We don't have those provisions.
It's either parental placement or it's not.
And Judge, at this point, we argue that it is a parental placement because in the statute definition that talks about whether a placement can be made, the other argument I would have there, Judge, is that it allows the legal guardians of a child to place the child for adoption. And I would argue in this case, at the time that we're looking at...
Had either parent consented to DSS assuming custody of the child?
Judge, there was no record that indicated that they consented
on the record.
In fact,
there's a finding by the J&D court of abuse and neglect.
There is, Judge.
Isn't that the requisite finding that permitted the court to then take custody, to assign custody to DSS?
It is. Under the 16.1 statutory scheme, at that point, DSS is allowed to allow that placement to be maintained. However, that does not trigger the foster care determinations that then usually come after that. And in this case, that's exactly what happened, is they just made a determination of custody. This child was in my client's custody. They were the legal guardians. I would argue that you can read the parental placement definition, that they could then place the child for adoption themselves. I understand that the court wants to try to fit this into a category very nicely, and I would submit that.
Right, I think what the court's concerned with, and I think the trial court was concerned with, is this seems to be an attempt to subvert the statutory scheme that's set out by the General Assembly. Adoption is jurisdiction for adoption lays with the circuit court, and this appears to be both in the proceeding in the J&D court as well as the use of the appealed J&D order to obtain a consent, to obtain an adoption decree and attempt to subvert this process.
And Judge, I would argue that it is not, because if you look at 63.2-1202 subsection A, that's where we started to find, even if it wasn't a parental placement adoption, that you would start in 1202A to determine what proceedings to go on. And then 1202A does reference using the juvenile court's consent proceedings at that time.
Counsel, excuse me, would you agree with me that if this wasn't a parental placement case, that the juvenile court had no authority to find that the father's consent was withheld contrary to the best interest of the child?
No, I would not, Judge. I think that the juvenile court still had the authority under 1233 to make that determination. Again, I would argue that 1233 subsection 3 can be read in several different ways, and that's what I indicated in my supplemental brief.
This whole code provision presupposes that there's parental placement. It's the only place in the code that I can determine that gives juvenile court authority to determine that consent's being withheld, and that's only under the parental placement statute.
That's correct, Judge.
So where's the authority, assuming that it's not parental placement, where's the authority for the juvenile court to determine consent's withheld?
Judge, the only authority that I have been able to see is under 1202 subsection A that specifically addresses a circuit court adoption and then specifically says that if there is a ruling that the circuit court would allow a ruling from a juvenile court that is done pursuant to 1233 or using the provisions of 1233, and it kind of scoops the 1233 provisions into 1202A.
To follow up on Judge Frank's question and your response, 1233 is predicated on the district court being satisfied that all requirements of 63.2-1232 have been met with respect to at least one birth parent. You go back to 1232, and it requires consent of one birth parent.
which is, of course, in direct contravention to then the 1233 subsection 2 provisions that say consent is not required if...
Of the other parent. One parent has to consent before 1233 even kicks in. I mean, that's the clear language and the clear import of both of those sections when read together. And I would agree with you 100% if the mother had given her consent. The J&E court would have had jurisdiction to determine whether consent was being withheld by the father. But I'm hung up on the fact that we don't have either party consenting, and the J&E court's still involved.
And, Judge, I think the issue with that is...
Mean, under the statute, juvenile court would then be required to determine custody, right? Under 3.
Under subsection 3, again, the juvenile court still has authority to make a determination, but if you read it that way, then yes, the determination should have been at least a custody determination if the consents couldn't be withheld.
Well, it says they shall, which means that's mandatory language. They got to do it.
Which, if you look at 1233 subsection 2, it says a birth parent. And so the reading of that, I think there are several different inconsistencies within 1233 itself. Sometimes it says a birth parent. Sometimes it says birth parents, and then the S is in parentheses. So there are some differences, I think, when you read through that to determine that. I think the court could have arguably made a determination that it did have jurisdiction to make those, because there's a little bit of a conflict there. As I said before, I think this was a hybrid case. And I would ask the court to find that it is a parental placement based on the fact that the parents in this case, I mean, essentially they abdicated their responsibility. And you can't argue that they consented expressly, but by the fact that they did not pursue custody with these children, I think that there's a good argument for the court to find that because the birth mother initially did place this child with my clients, not subject to just the authority.
You're running out of time. Yep. I've got to give a response to one question. Okay. We've talked about J&E and all this. So what about our court? What is your position on whether the order that was appealed from is a final order to vest us with jurisdiction?
Judge, I agree with counsel's argument that it is a final order. I do not believe that this court is bound by the circuit court's later determination or orders that would seem to indicate that the original order signed in February was final. You have an order that essentially dealt with all the aspects of the case at that point in time. That order itself was not suspended or vacated. You have subsequent orders by the court that indicate the court intended for it to be final. And then, Judge, you have the fact that conflicts with what the later orders of the court were made.
But doesn't that leave us in a situation where we are exercising jurisdiction over an order that the circuit court has later suspended?
My argument, Judge, and I mentioned this in the lower court arguments in the July hearing, was that the court did not have the jurisdiction to make any further orders. I believe that the statutes and the case law is clear that once an order is appealed to the Court of Appeals, the trial court loses the authority to make additional orders related to that same matter. So even the subsequent orders that were made...
If it's a final order, but there's also an opinion that says if you appeal an interlocutory order, the court can continue with the case subject to being corrected if we should reverse the interlocutory order.
And so my answer, Judge, would be to look at the final order that was, in fact, eventually signed by Judge Martin, which essentially said the exact same thing, almost word for word, that the February order did. It made no material differences between that order. And so that order, I think, subject to the rules of the court, you would have to look at that.
But hasn't he suspended that order?
He has not, Judge. In fact, the last order that was entered just this week, and I know it's part of the circuit court's record, but it may not have sent back up to you, but there's an order entered October 12th that actually vacates the order of August 27th in this case.
We're the last to know anything.
Really? And no harm, no foul, Judge. That was just Monday.
Your time is up, unless there are other questions. I noticed that the guardian ad litem is seated at your table, and you did not agree to share any time with her. However, if the guardian ad litem wishes to address the court, and certainly he would be interested in an abbreviated statement from the guardian ad litem.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, I'm Carrie L. Bailey, and I appreciate the time. The difficulty in this case is that I think there are so many issues that make it a hybrid versus the case law that is available. So number one, I would say that my client, the child at question here, was placed by the birth mother in the physical custody of the adoptive parents, prospective adoptive parents, and she has never left their physical custody.
You're talking about the physical custody.
Correct. And you had asked, I believe it was you, Your Honor, had asked about the legal custody. And I would respectfully disagree with counsel for the parent, for the birth parent, the adoptive parents, in that when the child was placed in the physical care on or about November 24th, 2005, the birth parents de facto retained legal custody of their child. It wasn't until a four-day period of time from December 5th, 2005, when there was a, quote, removal, and then up until December 9th, when legal custody was transferred to the parties. So for that 4 days, there was a legal determination of legal custody. But prior to that, I would argue, there wasn't. It retained.
When this child had to register to go to school or go to a doctor, what document did the potential adoptive parents show to prove that they had the right to enroll the child or take it to a doctor?
I do not. No, I would be speculating that they would, the dispositional order
on
that,
J&D court.
Which is the first time that they were granted legal custody.
And that's in June of 2006.
Actually, December 9th, 2005. I believe it's December 9th, but by my calculation, there were...
December 7th, 2006 is the date that the...
And when did Social Services get custody?
They had legal custody only. They never had physical custody, which is why I would say, Your Honor, that it is respectfully a hybrid case, because when a, quote, removal is done, they physically take the child. Even if the child is taken to the agency for a matter of hours before a relative placement can be found, they at some point have physical custody of the child. In this case, they never had physical custody.
Well,
there
child,
was a four-day period. The child was in the hospital until November 24th. From November 24th until present, the child has never not been in the physical custody of the Optrixes. So on December 5th, when the emergency removal order occurred, and the quote, I'm using quotes because one thinks of a removal in these cases, it's the physical removal of a child from the physical presence of the parents. That is not at all what happened, and that's why I would argue it's a hybrid.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Under 63.2.12.18, that prohibits fees and whatever, the whole purpose of the statute is essentially it can't sell babies for adoption.
Absolutely.
All right. And then we get to 1233 or 1232. It seems to me that once social services intervene 4 days afterwards, that any problems about baby placement, selling babies, whatever, has been eliminated because of the intervention of social services.
I understand your question, Your Honor, but respectfully, I would disagree with that. The provisions under a parental placement adoption for the home study and then the delegation of the authority for a juvenile court to waive that requirement, those are other provisions that are within the code to protect the buying and selling of babies. So it's not just whether social services, there are other frameworks within the code that protect for that exact reason.
No, but under these facts, social services now involved. They have, you know, a duty to filed various reports and whatever. So doesn't that obviate the need to worry about the motive for parental placement? You follow my question?
Right. And I follow your question, but again, I would argue that's what makes this such a difficult hybrid case, is that the agency never, ever had physical custody of this child, ever. The only parties
were...
Is that
something that happens quite often? That the child goes directly from, say, a hospital to the foster care parents, never passes into the arms of the DSS worker?
On occasion that happens, but usually that is when an emergency removal is filed prior to or immediately upon the release of the child from the hospital. That is not what happened here. From November 24th, 2005, until December 5th, 2005, the parents retained the natural assumed legal custody of their child up until the legal custody was given to the agency, even though physical custody never resided with the agency. And 4 days later, on December 9th, 2005, the temporary legal custody was for the first time given to the Ottrixes. Prior to that, it just retained, just like any other parent who gives birth. They don't have a physical order of a court that is legally their child, but the assumption is that it is. And that is why I would argue that this is a parental placement adoption, because it was the mother who gave birth and the mother who put forward the name of the Ottrixes in order to take custody.
Under 12, 333, if neither parent gave consent, what authority did juvenile court have to determine that consent was withheld contrary to the best interest of the child?
Certainly. And I would argue that that's what makes this such a hybrid, is because from 2005 until this ruling in 2017, the natural assumption would be that someone had to have custody of this child. And not that I'm using a term of art, but essentially de facto custody was relinquished.
To me, that doesn't make any difference. The statute is clear. It says that the only way that the juvenile court can determine that consent's withheld is when you have one parent consenting and one parent that doesn't. Isn't that clear language of the statute?
To me, Judge, that is not the clear language of the statute, because I think the different sections of the statute, as reflected in our supplemental brief, leave various places in the code where it seems that the sections contradict one another. For example,
counsel,
parent versus parents.
Let me interrupt you just for a moment, and we need to wrap this up. But obviously, there's a lot of back and forth here. But ultimately, when you go all the way back to the court getting involved, when the Department of Social Services moved forward on emergency removal, they were given legal custody. The parents had no custody. They had no legal rights at that point in time, unless you went from the emergency removal, you went then ultimately forward until you got to the dispositional. And in reference to that, once you had the dispositional, you had nothing. The parents had no, once the court ruled on that, they didn't have any legal rights to that child. So how do you now back up and say that they can consent to a parental placement?
So my argument is that that is, again, one of the things that makes this a hybrid, because the parents not only didn't have custody of the child after the date that the birth mother placed the child with the Ottrixes, they have never, either one, and the record reflects that, ever attempted to obtain custody. So it would be an absurdity to think that a child for 12 years could have no one have her custody.
Is there anything in the record that supports your argument that the birth parents, particularly in this case the birth mother, legally gave custody to the Ottrixes? Ottrixes, excuse me, I can't pronounce it.
The Ottrixes?
I would just refer the court back to page 198 in the section where sub 3 on page 198 where it indicates that at that time the birth mother that the friends who are the Ottrixes were willing to care for the child until the mother.
Now, I understand that's where they may have wanted the child to go, but there has to be something that transfers legal custody to these people in order for them to have legal custody. I'm looking at a J&D order that does just that, but that's based on a petition from DSS alleging abuse and neglect. I can't find anything blessed by the court or otherwise that transfers legal custody to anyone.
The other part that I wanted to point out, Your Honor, respectfully, on page 198 is the next section in sub 4. At that point in time, the whereabouts of the parents were unknown. So, again, it would lead to an absurdity that you have to have some sort of written order or consent of people whose whereabouts can't be located. And that's, again, what makes this so difficult.
That's when you go to the J&D court and you obtain court approval. But right. I can't imagine this child being taken to a doctor and the doctor say, well, wait a minute, you're not her parents. How can I treat her? And they say, oh, trust me, mom said I could have the child.
Certainly. And the first time that the order was entered was December 5th that gave, for those 4 days, legal custody to DSS and then transferred actual legal custody to the Ottrixes from December 9th.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe this has been fully vetted, but you still have a little bit of time on your rebuttal, and certainly I've been generous with, so I don't want to cut you off either. But I think we've gone down every avenue we could with this case.
Your Honor, I'll be brief. The mother never gave custody, legal custody, to anyone in this case. That was the whole reason. Once she said she wanted to pick up the child, social services filed their petition. I'm not sure where the term hybrid comes. There's nothing in the code that would indicate some sort of hybrid adoption. This is either a parental placement or it's not. And I think, as you've said, we've gone through that road quite completely. We would ask you to reverse the circuit court's ruling and to dismiss the petition for consent.
Thank you. We will come down and greet counsel.